And welcome to Expert Radio. Sorry about the little glitch there in sound. No problem. You can hear the archives. We'll hear everything. It's just one of the wonderful things that we run into with Internet Radio, our AccuWindow forecast tonight. In eastern Kentucky, up against the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, rainy. However, it's in the mid-40s, which is encouraging. Tomorrow it's supposed to be partly sunny and 50. We might even get out and do a little two-wheel meditation. That's called riding motorcycles. You never know. The phone line is going to be open all night, so please make use of them. Can use all the help we can get tonight. We're going to review Eric Von Däniken's book, History Was Wrong, tonight. Couldn't get one of their spokespeople to come on with us, but I thought the book was good enough, and the recap of some of this great information that started a religious revolution back in the 70s was worth reviewing again. The solar wind is holding at 332.4 kilometers per second. Sunspot 1040 did survive and has passed again over the western limb of the sun. Although it is large at 40 times the diameter of the Earth, it has not caused any flares yet. We'll keep an eye on it for you. By the way, last Friday was an apogee moon. Interesting. This is a moon that is full and can cause a full eclipse, except that it's at the furthest distance of its ellipse. And so that means that it's not large enough to eclipse the sun. So the moon is the furthest away possible. I'm wondering, those of you out there that are close to the ocean, if the tides are less than they normally are, since the moon is further away. That would be an interesting thing to know. If you have any information on that, you can give us a call. The number is 415-762-1161. Rebounding from a lost year in 2008, United Launch Alliance, that's the ULA, posted a strong campaign in 2009 that included 8 launches between its Atlas V and Delta IV families of rockets. Now the company will be put to the test in 2010 as the U.S. government asks to launch the Atlas V and Delta IV vehicles a combined 10 times. That is a lot of activity. That's like going from total scarcity to 110% of production. So we'll see if they can hold up. Basically, it is like if you go to Hertz rental car to rent a car 5 times and they don't have any cars left. Sooner or later, you're going to pick another city or you're going to pick another car company. This ULA does not want people to pick another company. The company's Atlas V and Delta IV rockets were developed under the Air Force's Evolved Expendable Launch Vehicle program, that's called the EELV program. You know, government always has acronyms for things, to ensure access to space for the government and for commercial customers. Don't really know what they're sending out in space. We'll try to keep tabs on it for you. If it's anything really strange or secret, we'll try to divulge everything to you. Scientists in Britain plan to become the first in the world to produce unlimited amounts of synthetic human blood from embryonic stem cells for emergency infection-free transfusions. A major research project to be announced this week that will culminate in 3 years with the first transfusions into human volunteers of synthetic blood made from the stem cells of spare IVF embryos. O-negative blood is relatively rare, applicable to, about 7% of the population. But it could be produced in unlimited quantities from embryonic stem cells because of their ability to multiply indefinitely in the laboratory. Those of you that got out recently and saw Daybreakers, you might want to give us a call. You know, it's kind of interesting, and we were talking about this the other day. What is the phenomenon with vampire movies? I was speaking to my favorite bookstore owner. By the way, if you're in the Western Kentucky area, make sure to swing into Madisonville. It's on the Penny Rile Parkway. I want you to talk to the owner of Read More Books in the mall. That's a catchy name. It's right across from the public library, and they sell the heck out of books. They sell the heck out of our books, which we really like. And by the way, the fourth book is getting ready to come out. We're finishing it up now. It should be ready for the publishers by the end of the month. We're excited about it. I'm not going to tell you the name yet because it isn't copyrighted yet. So as soon as that process is done, we'll let you know what the name is, but I promise you, you're going to like it. And if you make your way up to Trout Lake this summer during the July 4th weekend, you're going to get to see the presentation. So you'll really enjoy it. It's taking quantum mechanics and time travel and the physics of the soul. Excuse me. Had to hit my cough button there. To the next level, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. It's got some parts to it that are near and dear to my heart and maybe reveal something about myself and might reveal something about you as well. But the bottom line is that this phenomenon on vampires is really something. And we wondered, gee, is it the fascination with blood or is it the quasi-eternal life aspect about it that is so fascinating? I know if you watch the Twilight series or if you've read the books or seen the movies, it has become quite popular with young people, this pale look with cherry red lips and moosed hair and, looking like you don't need the sun in order to survive, walking around with the perpetual anemia. But I don't know that it's that look that is so engaging. Perhaps it's just the ability to look different, to be viewed of as different, to be afraid of blending or conforming with society in any way. But it could be the quasi-eternal internal life aspect in the sense that once you become a vampire, well, of course you're dead, but you actually live forever in your death. Yeah, I'm sure that's really attractive somehow, but I think there's another way, and I think we can talk a little bit about that in the second hour. We might talk about the ascension process. You know, we've heard a lot about that, and we don't really understand what it means, obviously, because the things that I read in the press, the things that I read on the internet or here on the radio are way off base, in my opinion, which is, of course, limited. There have been 27 earthquakes in the past 24 hours, and only four of them over 5.0. One off the coast of Argentina was strong, but it was deep, and it caused no damage. The Earth has surprised us in the last month with major volcanic activity, powerful quakes in Haiti, and unprecedented cold across both hemispheres. We are throwing the old trends out the window. So I want to talk a little bit about that in the first hour because there is a fear that goes along with this as the Earth begins to go off the charts, as it were, and change its behavior and perhaps go through these convulsions like it's trying to vomit the race of man from its surface. And some interesting discussions can come out of that because I think you need to understand what's going on there. The jet stream has shifted, expanding the deserts, of course. The Gulf Stream has moved further out to sea off the coast of the U.S., which means fishing boats have to go further out to sea to get to that warm river of seawater where life abounds. The polar caps are expanding at more than 10,000 square miles a day. The heliosphere is being invaded by high-energy particles left behind by an ancient supernova. What does it mean for us? How could the ancient Maya have seen what we are facing now? Well, let's talk about it. tonight as we begin our program. We'll be back in 40 seconds. This is X Squared Radio. I'm Brooks Agnew. X Squared Radio is where the past meets the future. We bring it all together right here in a mathematical formula called X Squared. The results are always positive. Unless, of course, you put the imaginary number I in there. I is the square root of negative 1. Obviously, squaring that gives you a negative number. And so that's why I would prefer to leave I out of the program. But since we have no guests coming on in the month of January, not for want of trying, we've certainly scheduled them, but time after time, other things come up. It is a very trying time for a lot of people. They're traveling. They're in foreign countries. They're working hard, earning money, trying to make a living, trying to overcome the effects of a very, very strange economy. 2010 is the year of hope for us. For the first time in more than 70 years, the world is on the threshold of an era of peace. I know that is not what you hear in the news, but the truth is that we are at a turning point for the human race. The neural net is connecting us together in ways we never dreamed of even 15 years ago. And when people communicate, they resolve their differences. The metamorphosis of the neural net, also known as the internet, has connected people, regardless of time zones, around the world. It has allowed people to share ideas from free nations to not so free nations, from innovative nations to not so innovative nations. People are people. Souls evolve just like life evolves. And what happens is this tremendous desire to come together, to communicate, to reach out to one another is somehow being satiated. And yet it's also being excited. It's also reaching its own viral strength. And the interesting thing about this is it's evolving in ways that the designers, a la Al Gore, had no idea that it would. For instance, we have now added new words to our lexicon. You'll remember 25 years ago, nobody knew what the word click meant. You know, click, click on this, click on that. What are you talking about? Or go ahead and download this. What does download mean? You know, in 1995, nobody even knew what a browser was. And then words that we never heard before or that we have used in completely different context became some of the most successful companies in the world. Google. Google? Yeah, Google. You know, Google is a noun. Oh, yeah, Google is a verb, too. Google this, Google that. I'm sure 10 years ago, nobody had any idea what a Google was. Yahoo. Yahoo? Yahoo is something cowboys yell as they grab their hat and jump on a wild horse. Yahoo is one of the most successful corporations of all time. Its search engines and abilities to connect advertisers with buyers has been a phenomenon. Skype. Skype? Is that anything like a... Nope, that's a snipe. Don't even know where the word Skype came from. But it is a remarkable communication tool. In fact, we're coming to you live on it tonight. It is the ability to place voice over the internet in a way that's crystal clear around the world so that you can tune in anywhere you want, anytime you want, and gain all the information you want. Now, we used to call that the library. And then after the library, we used to call it a school, elementary school, middle school, high school, secondary school, and then college, universities, master's degrees, PhDs. You know, when I was finishing up my PhD, my proctor said, Brooks, you know, as you finish this program, you certainly put years of work into it prior to even starting the PhD program. When you finish, I challenge you to read 4 books in your field a year. And then every 4 years, it's like adding another PhD to your accreditation. And I took the challenge, except instead of reading 4 books, I read 50 books. Well, come on, people. What does 50 books do a year for 10 years? Well, that's nonfiction. We're not talking about novels. We're not talking about romance novels or science fiction novels. We're talking about hard science. We're talking about quantum physics. We're talking about mechanics, dynamics, fluid dynamics, logic. Read a book called Gödel, Escher, Bach and understand the relationship between the fugues of Bach and the repetitive artwork of Escher and the poetry of Gödel. This transitory relationship of knowledge from one thing to another, from music to mathematics, from architecture to politics, from sociology to biology, this way of transferring knowledge across the language barrier. You know, one of the nice things about Google is you can take any note written to you by anyone in any language, stick it in Google, translate it in 60 seconds, and you can now communicate, in writing at least, almost, in any language you wish. That is unprecedented, Earth Explorers. And so what it has done, it has placed us on the threshold of peace. And there are doubters. Someone asked me during the week, off the air, what I thought the shadow government was going to do this year. I had to think about it, you know. Right now, there is a feeling of anarchy in the air. That is to say, the old dogma of religion is shifting into spirituality. The accreditation of university system is losing its value in our society. Not that people are negating or nullifying an education. Oh, far from it. They're just not going to the accredited university system to get it. Because the university professors themselves, the textbooks from which they preach, are outdated and have incorrect ideas. And what has happened is the ideas upon which they base your higher education, being false, being outdated, being fables and superstitions, are trying to form the leaders of tomorrow. In the meantime, there are people out there being homeschooled, and they're coming out of the homeschool system far brighter and far more inquisitive with their intelligence intact. And they're moving on well past those accredited students. By the way, this just in, the guys of the company came up with Sky Peer to Peer, which soon shortened to Skyper. But as happens in the internet world, some of the domain names associated with Skyper were already taken. So they thought, what the heck? Let's just drop the R and make it Skype. It sounded good. And the domain, all of them, were available. And so that's where Skype came from. Isn't that interesting? By the way, domain names also became the real estate of great value for about 3 years. Case in point, Delta Faucets and Delta Airlines, both trademarked names, both trademarked very successful Fortune 500 companies. Eventually, Delta Faucets gave up Delta.com, and now Delta Airlines has the domain name. I imagine there was a fair amount of money that exchanged hands as well. And it kind of became the squatter's world of the 21st century. I remember speaking to investors about a company that I wanted to form back in the mid-90s. Went down to Florida, met with them, made a nice presentation, thought it went very well, came back to Tennessee, where I lived at the time, went to start the website and found that the company name had been taken by the very investors that I had gone to see in Florida. I guess you know the rest of the story. We didn't do business with them. In any case, let's get back to this shadow government. The banking system has become a bloated and greedy system of usury that plunges its fangs into the smallest of communities, bleeding the hard work of the small business into the bonus tanks of the highest paid brokers and bankers in history. No matter where you go in America, the most expensive buildings are banks. And when the small businessman goes to get a loan to expand his business, the bank's policies block him at every turn. The Department of Energy publicly states that they offer loans and grants to small businesses, but the fine print requires the applicant to prove he is able to expand his own business and remain profitable without the government's money before he qualifies for the government's money. Oh, I'm sorry. I meant your money. Actually, it's your money in both cases. The bank uses the money that you deposit and that you leave in your checking account as their basis for buying money from the Federal Reserve, which they then loan back out to those who actually don't need the money. And the stock for the bank is usually held by the wealthiest people in the area, or, as usually happens with the larger acquisitions, out-of-state banks, national banks, and even world banks come in and buy the more profitable branches, and then the interest money that would normally have stayed in the community, used to serve the community, is drawn out into even larger tanks of blood that feed the vampires of the financial world. Washington, D.C. is a cowboy town. Each department prints their own money, makes their own rules, and answers to no one. The president is a powerless puppet, trying to talk and walk like a leader, but is as inconsequential as reruns of Who's the Boss. So, the unity of national leaders has been circumvented, as it were, by the unity of the people. While the shadow governments of the past were planning to take over the world's finances in one giant alchemical coup d'etat, the people stopped going to the store and stopped borrowing money to keep them in business. People started falling in love with one another across oceans and through impassable mountains, and in spite of forbidden borders. So what happened was, by the way, alchemy, just by way of definition, is the pure art of changing base metals into gold. More perfectly defined, it is changing that which is worthless into that which is of great value. The Freemasons, during the Crusades, set up a system of banks, as it were, along the road to Jerusalem so that pilgrims could travel from Europe to Jerusalem without being robbed along the way because they had to carry large amounts of gold and jewels and things with them so they could make the exchange from one country to the other, as they most surely needed supplies along the way. The Freemasons, the Knights Templar, decided to develop a system whereby people could deposit their gold and their jewels and their home area, let's say Germany, and then they could travel to Jerusalem with a set of chits that they had. They were also called checks. And as they went to different Freemason Knights Templar establishments along the way, they could simply walk up and present the coded check to the bank, which would then withdraw a small amount of money in local currency so that that pilgrim could negotiate whatever financial transactions they had to make in that area. And if they were robbed, the checks were worthless to the robber because only the person knew the code. Now the question is, and this is rather remarkable to figure out, is that the pilgrims could go hundreds and hundreds of miles along well-worn horse paths from village to village, town to town, city to city, that were not connected by phone lines or internet or anything else. And somehow, those checks were good. Now, the interesting thing is that the whole system developed so much value so quickly that royalty felt like they were not having access to this kind of wealth. In fact, it was the Knights Templar that were developing the wealth. It was the banking stations along the way, these castles that seemed to be developing the wealth. Where in the world were they getting this unbelievable, unlimited supply of money? How are they moving the wealth back and forth between where they made the deposits and where they had to make the loans along the way, the disbursements, the withdrawals? It was such a fascinating quandary that when Philip the Fair came to power, he lusted so badly after the power and wealth of the Knights Templar that he orchestrated an international wave of raids on all the castles everywhere. And when they broke into the banks, guess what they found? Nothing. Nothing. They got nothing. And they tortured and they killed and they beheaded and they tortured and they broke bones and they quizzed these men out by the thousands to try to find the wealth. And they never gave it up. So the shadow government, as the popular culture says, is a small group of families out there. Some have said 125. Some have said a little over 250. Some have said 300. Some have said they're the Bilderbergers. Some have said they're Illuminati. I have no doubt that the Bilderberger conference does occur. But I can tell you from experience, not having been there, of course, but having been in the company of several of the people who have been rumored to been Bilderbergers, that the more greedy people you will not find in the history of mankind. Each person crossing that threshold into that meeting is greedier than the next. And thus are hoping for and perhaps planning for the demise and takeover of everyone else in the group. Now, I can also tell you from experience that you can't form a company that way. If you have a company of men, brilliant or women, brilliant as they may be, if every single one is greedier than the next and only hoping for the demise, illness, and invalidity of the next, it doesn't make for a unified push forward. In fact, no unity whatsoever comes out of it. You might have presenters, and you might have a lot of handshaking and a lot of smiles going on, and a lot of margaritas being bought. But you're not going to have any loyalty. you're not going to have any kind of trust between these people. Their God is cash. Their God is power. And if you want to see what power does to someone, look at the public figures. Look at the ones who are in the camera every day. And you don't even have to look at them every day. Look at them every 5 days. Look at them every 30 days. Just compare a picture of Obama the day he was elected and today. Are they the same man? Oh, yes, of course they are. But one is 15 years older than the other. Because his life force is being drained out of him because he is being cheated and lied to and deceived at every single turn. Who can he trust? Can he trust his own wife? Can he trust his own Secret Service? Can he trust his own secretary? Can he trust his staff, his cabinet, the news media? You know the answer. There is no unified shadow government. There may be a shadow government, but they are a group of Hitlers and cons. They are a group of Mussolinis and Al Capones, and they will use any means at their disposal to get the maximum amount of wealth and power possible. And if you want to go by the Attila the Hun method of business, it is not enough to win. All others must lose. So, this unity that seems to be occurring spontaneously, like Google becoming an international sensation, like Yahoo becoming one of the largest, most powerful economic forces in business, like knowledge spanning across this neural net so quickly, live, and then instantly stored so it can be accessed by any time zone, anywhere. This sensation of people, thousands and thousands, millions of students coming out of the homeschool ranks, learning education at a rate far accelerated from that they would get in the normal school system. And they're not being subjected to the government's behavior programs. Yes, when they come out of the elementary and middle school areas and then they join the normal public high school, they're a little socially retarded at first. They don't quite blend in. They're not street wise. They don't know what is in fashion and what is not, what is in vogue to say, and what a look can mean in general public. But they come up to speed pretty quickly because they can outscore almost any student in the public school system. And they did it with their intelligence intact. Their ability to think, their ability to go from the known to the unknown. In fact, they seek out the unknown. They like taking tests. They like challenges. What do these people do when they get into a society that has been regimented like cattle going to a chute, destined to work at some arbitrarily set minimum wage by some government somewhere that tells a small business what their workers are worth? How does this phenomenon occur? People are falling in love with one another across oceans and through impassable mountains and in spite of forbidden borders. The question is, can we do it? Will we be able to manifest this new world we dream of? Are we going to keep reading the history books from the future, written by the powers that seek to control this race? Or do we have the courage to step off the path of destruction and scarcity mapped out for us by the few who anonymously reap the toll of our labors? Do we have the courage? Can we do it? Are we tooled up? Are we empowered? Are we able to do it? Give us a call, 415-762-1161. Let me know your thoughts. I can tell you it's about 250 million to 435. Not 435 million or 435,000. I mean 435 people. 250 million people are being manipulated, are being bled, are being coerced, are being denied access by 435 people. It doesn't sound right. It's been done before. Small armies intimidating large groups of people, hurting them, dehumanizing them, exterminating them. Are you alive or are you not? Oh, you might be breathing air. You might be respirating. You might meet the raw definition of life. You may even be propagating. You may even be productive. But are you alive? Are you conscious that you're conscious? You know, there is a life cycle in the life force of any people, of any race, and I'm going to call us the human race upon this planet. This cycle alternates between four states, like a wheel turning. You can read about this in Volume 3 of The Arc of Millions of Years. It doesn't matter where you start. It's a cycle. It's like a wheel. So here we go. The first one we're going to discuss, certainly not the first on the list, but we're just going to jump into the cycle anywhere. Mercy. No, I mean mercy is the place. Mercy is the starting point. It brings on peace. It drops the limitations of mankind and allows them to flourish unfettered. When you're merciful to one another, to yourself. There are no police because there's no call for them. The peaceful turn their cheek to the aggressor. They move out into the frontier, the wilderness, when things get a little too noisy, too mean, and too lean. And when the wilderness runs out, they move out into space, if they can. It has been the way of the universe since its beginning. But then the limits of society become apparent. 2% of the people refuse to obey the laws of ethics. They take advantage of the poor, the stupid, or the weak. They dig a pit for their neighbors, and they cheat at everything. Just to give you an example, hardly a state 30 years ago had a lottery. There was no widespread gambling. You could gamble if you went to Vegas. You could gamble if you went to Atlantic City. You could gamble if you went to Indian reservations, and some rivers even had gambling set up. But they were a trip. It was a destination. It was a purpose. You saved up all year, and then you took a week and you went and entertained yourself by spending your money on the crap table or the roulette or the one-armed bandits. But then states began adding lotteries. Now, it's expressly forbidden in the U.S. Constitution to have a national lottery. We can't do that. It's actually spelled out in the Constitution. You'll remember, if you look at your history, that Europe had fallen into a national lottery and had all but been destroyed by it. And so the founders of this nation decided to keep that out. And now what we have is state lotteries, which advertise on a regular basis on radio and television, billboards, newspapers, and hardly a store can you visit without having access to some kind of gambling device. Now, for me, it could be a way for the universe to bless you with great wealth. But for me, it looks like a tax. It sounds like a tax, it smells like a tax, and it works like a tax. But who does it tax? It taxes the poor. And it taxes the stupid. And they certainly pay more than their fair share. And so those that dig the pit for their neighbors don't worry about their neighbors falling into the pit. So that is mercy and peace. And it brings the criminals to the surface, 2% of them. And then what we do is we get the call for justice. We have to do something about this. First, the police force is organized to take care of the 2% to commit all the crime. Yes, yeah, it's the same 2%. If you go and just sit in the courtrooms for about 3 years, you will see the same faces coming in over and over and over again. They're not new faces. It's the same 2%. And then it escalates into national conflict, and war breaks out. For decades and even centuries, men and women take up arms and dehumanize one another into cannon fodder. Technology is driven and financed by fear, which further puts the human life at the end of a trigger, and then a button, and then a nameless program that operates a robot to do the killing. What technology that can't be turned into a weapon will be permitted to leak into the public domain, but if it shows promise as a weapon, it is confiscated, and the inventor is obfuscated into poverty. And it happens over and over and over and over again. Wealth is only allowed. Every once in a while, 30 years ago, someone could break out and become wealthy overnight. But if they weren't the right kind of wealth, then they didn't succeed. But now things are a little different. By the way, I have this just in. A new study explores why powerful people, many of them, take a moral high ground and don't practice what they preach. Researchers sought to determine whether power inspires hypocrisy, the tendency to hold high standards for others while performing morally suspect behaviors for oneself. The research found that power makes people stricter in moral judgment of others while going easier on themselves. The research was conducted by Joris Lammers and Diedrich A. Stapel of, it looks like, Tilburg University in the Netherlands, and by Adam Galinsky of the Kellogg School of Management at Northwest University in Evanston, Illinois. The article is to appear in a forthcoming issue of Psychological Science. This research is especially relevant to the biggest scandals of 2009 as we look back on how private behavior of 10 often contradicted the public stance of particular individuals in power, said Galinsky. For instance, he saw some politicians use public funds for private benefits while calling for smaller government, or have extramarital affairs while advocating family values. Similarly, we witnessed CEOs of major financial institutions accepting executive bonuses while simultaneously asking for government bailout money. And that's largely because their bonuses actually bankrupted the company. And when the government bonuses came in, and then the government said, oh, no, 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 you guys can't give out these bonuses because you got to pay back this bailout money first. guess what happened? Oh, yeah, they paid the bailout money back in record time so they could get those bonuses. And what do you say? Next year, they're right back at the table asking for bailout again. He goes on, according to our research, power and influence can cause a severe disconnect between public judgment and private behavior. And as a result, the powerful are stricter in their judgment of others by being more lenient toward their own actions, he continued. To simulate experience of power, the researchers assigned roles of high power and low power positions to a group of study participants. Some were assigned the role of prime minister and others civil servant, while participants were then presented with moral dilemmas related to breaking traffic rules, declaring taxes, and returning a stolen bicycle. Through a series of five experiments, the researchers examined the impact of power on moral hypocrisy. For example, in one experiment, the powerful participants condemned the cheating of others while cheating more themselves. High power participants also tended to condemn over-reporting of travel expenses. But when given a chance to cheat on a dice game to win lottery tickets played alone in a private cubicle, the powerful people reported winning a higher amount of lottery tickets than did low-power participants. Three additional experiments further examine the degree to which powerful people accept their own moral transgressions versus those committed by others. In all cases, those assigned to high-power roles showed significant hypocrisy by more strictly judging others for speeding, dodging taxes, and keeping a stolen bike, while finding it more acceptable to engage in these behaviors themselves, the researchers said. Galinsky said hypocrisy has its greatest impact among people who are legitimately powerful. In contrast, a fifth experiment found that people who don't feel personally entitled to their power are actually harder on themselves than they are on others, a phenomenon the researchers dubbed hypocrisy, the tendency to be harder on the self than on others, also characterized the powerless in multiple studies. Ultimately, patterns of hypocrisy and hypocrisy perpetuate social inequality. The powerful impose rules and restraints on others while disregarding these restraints for themselves, whereas the powerless collaborate in producing social inequality because they don't feel the same sentiment, Galinsky concluded. Now that's courtesy of the Association for Psychological Science, December 2009, and the World Science Staff. So, if you think that there is some moral high ground, some morally ethical group out there that is immensely powerful, controlling all money, controlling all access to money, controlling the wealth and controlling those who have access to the wealth, or denying access to the wealth wherever they can. If you think that when you go into the bank, you should show reverence, sort of like, we're in the bank now. Shh, there's money here. Be careful. You need to be very quiet in the bank. Don't be boisterous. No out loud laughing. Children, better not run in the bank. This is a very important place. And you know, most towns you go to, the banks kind of do look like churches. I mean, come on, let's be serious here. Do we really worship our money? This is a really good question. I can tell you when you go to the bank, as let's say you're 55 years old, you've been in business or have worked for a business for 20 or 30 years, And it comes time now you want to make that expansion. You want to buy that piece of equipment. You want to buy that building. You want to establish that line. You want to increase capacity. You want to make an acquisition of another business, which will add to yours and allow you to hire more people. And you go into the bank and you sit down at the desk across from the loan officer and you have your papers in order. Invariably, the loan officer is 20, 25, maybe even 30 years your junior. Has he been in business? No. He's dressed nice because the bank requires him to do so. He stands between you and your loan. And he actually represents a board of nameless, faceless people who sit in a loan committee, which no one knows when they meet or where they meet. There's no meeting room in the bank. There's no special loan approval ritual. But you fill out your papers and you make your case and you submit what you have to this junior who has never worked a day in his life outside the bank. He doesn't even know what a lathe sounds like. He doesn't know what a sale is. He doesn't know what it means to have the phone ring and provide you business. To go to sleep on a Friday night worrying whether you can make payroll the next Friday night. He doesn't know this feeling. He doesn't know what you reach down and grab each morning. He doesn't know the drive that pushes you through the day. What can I do today to earn money for my family and for the people that work for me? They don't know this feeling. They're not familiar with it. They don't know your business. They will never come to your business. They don't want to know your business. And when they ask you to call on Thursday and then Tuesday and then Thursday and then the following Tuesday, we're sorry, Mr. Smith. There's nothing we can do. The loan committee did not approve your loan. Well, you can't just go to the next bank and apply because now you're shopped. Now you've sullied your effort. Your credit is now besmirched with a minus 10 points. Just because the bank checked it out. And now you have rejection. Now you have denial. It's sort of like making your way across the dance floor to that one woman that you wanted to ask to dance. She looked at you when you looked at her. Oh, she was beautiful. And then you got the courage and you walked across and you said, "Would you like to dance?" And she said, "With you?" Yeah, as if. Yeah, that's the rejection you got. That's the feeling. You remember. That's the feeling. That's the bank. That's the way the world runs right now. So we'll take a 3 minute and 43 second break. Let you get a glass of water, let you change pages on your AutoCAD, and we'll be back. Don't go away. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio. Thank you. Lisa Gerard, Maranatha. The kind of music that opens the soul. Across the abyss of time, space, emotion, mankind is reaching one to another. Is it mercy? Is it love? Is it a great brotherhood, a great sisterhood that is out there? I can tell you that if you don't travel much, you don't get out much, you don't surf the net much, you don't communicate with people in other countries, you might not be aware of this, but there is a phenomenon occurring right now. There is a great phenomenon, and it is beginning to change everything. It's beginning to move the universe. And you are part of it here tonight on X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. The phone lines are open, 415-762-1161. And we'll be back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is about to begin hour two. Okay, those of you that have ordered the Ark of Millions of Years trilogy, they're going to be in the warehouse this week. We'll fill all the orders and ship those out. If you have a birthday coming up or you just missed out on Christmas and nobody got you one of the trilogy books, by all means, go to arkofmillionsofyears.com and purchase your copy today. We'll send it to you, and you get the audio versions for free. And it'll be a big help for you. Also, in the archives, many of you have begun to sign up again for the year. That's good. It's less than the price of a cup of coffee per month. Very inexpensive, very high quality, over 500 hours of content out there. And with some of the greatest authorities ever on the earth. And it's... I love the things that we talk about here on this program, whether it's the Egypt Code or whether it's the God Experiment or flying saucers or UFOs or aliens or Hollow Earth. And by the way, I'll give you a little bit of a Hollow Earth update. Good news, we are finally speaking with some capable investors, which means that we will very soon have the funding to be able to charter the ship. The Freedom Mission, which will be the first of three expeditions, one in 2010, one in 2011, and a final one, summer solstice 2012. They'll be called the Freedom, the Gemini, and the Genesis missions. Yes, their missions, their expeditions, the greatest expedition in the history of the world. We will let you know on the websites. The websites have been updated, and you can go to npiee.org, that's nippy.org, or you can go to phoenixsciencefoundation.org and click on the Apex link, and we'll try to keep those updated. You can stay up with what's going on. Let's go ahead and start the hour out by having Scott from Daytona on the program. Scott, welcome.
Hi, Dr. Brooks. Hi, I was just listening on the part where you were talking about power and such, and I'm a marriage and family therapist, and I was interested in what the findings were there. I was curious if righteousness goes along with power. And if that's something that those who seek power need to be careful in terms of their seeking, if they want to stay out of righteousness.
Well, I understand. I understand that the righteous are those who are moving toward God. There's no camping. There's no standing up and saying, I am righteous, because it's a little like being proud that you're humble. It is a process of movement. It is a process of growth that is righteousness. To say that power and righteousness go hand in hand, I think you're probably right. But you're talking about real power. Power that actually comes from, you know, resonating with the Creator. Power, as man would say, is power, is the power of a banker or the power of an insurance company or a power of a government official who happens to be occupying a position at the goodwill of the people. You're right. There's a big difference between the power of righteousness and the power as man may perceive it.
And I was by the ocean today in Daytona, just as an aside, and it was very windy, but the ocean seemed to be, it was high tide, almost high tide, but I don't know if that was any different than normal with the moon being where it's at with its apogee.
Well, that's good. I would have love to have had a measurement on that. I guess I'm going to have to go to the Atlas or the Almanac and see if the tide is as high as it normally is. You probably wouldn't notice too much in Daytona. Where you'd really notice it would be someplace like Alaska, where they have like 36 feet between high tide and low tide because of the high latitude.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, I've seen steps on a dock in Florida might be, 5 or 6 feet, from high tide to low tide, maybe 10 feet, but in some of the islands off the coast of Alaska, it's like 40 feet from low tide. You have to walk up 40 steps to get to the dock, and then at high tide, the water comes all the way up to the dock, and you can step right off onto the boat. It's pretty amazing.
It used to be better here. They used to have the races way back in the early days, when 1920s, 30s, they had it out on the beach, and it was the beach was very flat, and it was almost like a quarter of a or an eighth of a mile rather from the seawall to low tide, and that was way back. But since the hurricanes came by, particularly in 1999, 2001, the ones that bypassed did the most damage, and the ones that actually were more of a hit. The ones that bypassed, they tore up they took the sand out, and now we don't have as much space at the beach for parking and the like.
I understand. You were talking that you had experience in spousal counseling. This is an intimate relationship where you see the effects of perceptions of power, and especially in relinquishing one's sovereignty to another. Can you, without revealing anything private, can you explain to us maybe what happens to a person when they relinquish their sovereignty to another for their, meaning to life?
Oh, gosh. I would hope that would happen in some cases, because a lot of the time what I deal with, I'm often in the situation where one side is against the other, and it's a battle. I often put myself in those situations because I think that's part of my personality drive. I'm a six on the Enneagram, and that integrates to the peacemaker, and then to the achiever, and then back to the peace, the safety and security. So I often put myself in situations where I'm working with couples who or families where it's where that's what's going on. And it's like a fight, and I'm trying to de-escalate and to put the fires out and get to a place where people can talk and work together. I think in terms of the parent-child relationship, in working with parents who have teenagers, when the teenagers can actually work with a parent in some cases, where in some cases they don't want to, but working with the parents, that way, giving up their, okay, I can do whatever I want to, okay, I'll follow your guidelines. That often, I've seen that a lot. I have seen in marriage situations where they have, where people have relinquished power, but it's often more of an exit than what's going to maintain. It's more of a situation where one might be exiting the relationship. Okay, have it your way, but I'm leaving, sort of thing.
Yeah, I can see that. I had four teenagers of my own, which is not like 1, 2, 3, 4. That's like 2 to the 4th power. I also was a scoutmaster for 6 years, and I had 18 boys, only 4 of whom had fathers. So I know that this sharing of power, this relinquishing of one's sovereignty to another, has a lot to do with the quality of the person that's in charge. Let me just be a little more specific on that. I have been in the grocery, for instance, ignominiously pushing my cart around and filling it with things that don't embarrass me too much. And I have noticed other parents correcting their children in the store. And it goes something like this: get over here, stop touching that, don't move, and I'm sorry, we can't buy that today. And this is a child that's trying to follow the instruction of a parent that's giving the child no useful information whatsoever. I see the same thing in teenagers. A teenager says something like, hey, I want to go out with my friends. No, you can't. Why? Because I said so. I heard that myself when I was a kid. I never actually uttered those words ever to my kids. In fact, I told them, don't ever accept no for an answer from me. If I tell you no, I want you to make your case. And I may still say no. I may still say, you know, I don't have a good feeling about this, but it's going to be rare. And you're going to respect it. And you'll see it'll turn out right. And it has. But sometimes they make a very effective case to me. And I say, you know what? I am actually being a little short-sighted on this. You have done this and you have done that. And you've been home every time I've asked you to be home. And you did your chores. And you know what? I changed my mind. Yes, you can go. And those are the kinds of exchanges that develop such a great relationship between parents and children, because the few times that you say no, it's because you have a good reason. Even if you don't have to explain what it is to much more depth than what you want to. Like I had my oldest son one time said, I'm called me up at 11:30 at night and said, I want to go riding around with my friends. And I said, you know, nothing good happens after midnight. I think you should go ahead and come home. He said, okay, Dad. So he came home. So the next day, one of his friends came in with stitches, a black eye and stitches on his chin. And we said, hey, Brian, what happened to you? He said, well, I went riding around last night with my friends, and the rodeo flipped, and I was in the back seat. And I turned to my son. I said, where would you have been riding, Ben? He said, in the back seat, Dad. I said, okay, enough said. So those are the kinds of things that built a great relationship. And by the way, of those 18 boys that were in my Boy Scout troop, all but 2 became Eagle Scouts. And that is very rare. Usually it's 2 out of 100 that become Eagle Scouts. Something about realizing that these are young adults in a child's body, and they want to think like an adult, but they don't have the maturity to act like an adult, and it's up to the parent to help them do that. Now, what does that mean to a husband-wife relationship? We talked about kids and maybe exiting partners if they're trying to work things out and they're trying to get this power thing to work in a marriage, how does it function correctly?
Correctly, there should be a balance. Like, you know, okay, this is the realm where the wife has power. This is the realm where the husband has power. And there should be more of an equitable distributing of that power. But, of course, now in modern marriages, you know, it used to be that the home was the woman's domain of power and work was the man's, but now it's redistributed to more equal, or maybe the woman is working and the man is staying at home. And so it's then it becomes, you know, men take that really hard because they've traditionally been out there in the working world making the money, and now it may not be so. And, you know, I had one other thing, you know, when you were talking about what you experienced in the grocery store, it's kind of like children need to be given the positive command, like, let's be still, let's be calm, and we're gonna give you one toy, and so on and so, you know, that sort of thing, where it's, you know, where the borders are set and they get the positive word instead of don't move, don't go over there. You know, and all this other stuff, because the children hear move, or they hear, you know, they hear the second word. They hear, they don't hear the don't. So, you know, if you say don't move to a young child, you know, they hear move. You know, I often have started to, lately, use a lot of positive suggestions with children and adolescents I'm working with in terms of instilling a positive belief. I'm successful at everything I do. I succeed at everything I do. I'm valued. I'm loved. That sort of thing, to get them in a positive place where they can develop a foundation for themselves and a belief in themselves and their own abilities and their own capacity.
Well, now I think you've really hit on it there. It's that self-love, that self-respect, and a realization that even Jesus had enemies. You can't be accepted by everyone. And sometimes you're going to be hated by most people. But if you love yourself and you know that you are a sovereign being making your own decisions and they're right and you feel good about them, then you could move ahead. And that's how leaders are born. They don't swim with the fish downstream. They swim upstream. And that's why we have fish every year.
Yes. Well, thank you, Dr. Brooks. We'll get up the air so other people can talk.
All right. Hey, thanks so much, Scott, for the call. And you can call back anytime. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good night. So we talk about power as man perceives it. And I guess for all intents and purposes, at least for this program tonight, we can say that man is who we're talking about. Can we pit man against God? Can we say that, you know, God is sitting somewhere out there or just behind a millimeter of dimension, just out of sight, somehow judging you or blessing you or cursing you? I suppose you could do that. I suppose you could say, my life is bad because God doesn't want it to be good. You could say that things are going poorly for me because the powers that be do not want them to go well for me. You can say that. And certainly there may, in fact, be forces whose intention is to see you fail. I'm not saying that those aren't out there. But that doesn't have anything to do with your relationship with yourself. If you love yourself and you know that you're right, even the efforts that fail are valuable. Does that mean you're a failure? No, it doesn't. In fact, one of my favorite people writes and says, your understanding of homeschool is right. It's fine for learning, centers a person in Christ, and in progress and proactive perception. Yes, of course. And for some reason, homeschool students finish their work, take the standardized tests, and outperform public school students. Now, those reasons could be that they're not in the fashion wars every day, and they're not worrying about what boy likes them or what girl likes them, or worse, what girl used to like you and now likes another, and that emotion is tied up into it. Pour in a healthy dose of, well, shall we call it an overdose of hormones, things that mess your face up, make you realize that for the first time in your life, your teeth are crooked, and your voice is cracking, and your body is changing, fat or skinny or bulging here or there, and now you've got a real recipe for a social mess, and some kids never recover from it. That is to say, they pour in some artificial substance to help them cope, whether it's their parents' prescriptions or something perhaps less controlled. In a homeschool situation, you don't have those stresses. Sure, they still interact with their age group in the neighborhood, in the hood, and maybe even at church and extracurricular activities. But with respect to the social structure into which we have plunged the human being, young and an adolescent and more or less abandoned by parents who believe that the child is in the way and should go off to school so mommy and daddy can do what they want to do, that is the recipe for disaster. But with homeschooling, you must have at least one, perhaps two, or even more committed parents. Sometimes parents pool their resources together, things that they're good at that another parent may not be good at. A parent may not know anything about biology, but be halfway decent at mathematics, and yet the neighbor's really good at biology. However, the rules and regulations governing homeschooling preclude the grouping together of any children in a quasi-school situation or setting, and that keeps people from competing directly with the school system. You realize that the students that are homeschooled are students that are drawing $2,000, $3,000, $7,000 a year away from those schools. So the schools are actively campaigning to destroy the homeschooling process for two reasons. One, those parents are knowingly and willingly taking money from the public school system, and or should I say denying the school system that money. Those parents don't actually get that tax money. Oh, they get taxed. It leaves their payroll checks. It leaves their income, but they don't get it back. They have to bear the cost of education on top of homeschooling, and the school gets the benefit of the tax from that person, that property tax from that person. Even if the person doesn't have children, they pay the property tax, which pays for the education, which you can say is a benefit to the community, because obviously having an educated youth, well, I guess you can already tell how I'm going to finish that sentence, because we see the results of what happens with an uneducated youth. Young people will eventually become adults. In fact, I have often said that men of high character are built from boys of high character, and one of the best places in the world to build a boy of high character is the Boy Scouts of America. So we have the tools to at least empower ourselves to grow, to think, to handle challenges as they come to us, but we're often not empowered by the banking system, by the insurance companies, by the lenders, by those investors who would help a businessman get his start. So we get back to this cycle, and we were just talking about this with Scott too, different terminology, same thing. We have this cycle of mercy, peace, justice, and war. These four words were actually put together by a friend of mine named Ken Payne, who lives in Tell City, Indiana. He is a great thinker, and certainly countless hours of pontification, sometimes with and sometimes without adult beverages, made for a great time in my life. this cycle of mercy, peace, justice, and war. Over and over again, our race goes through this. Each time we live through this, do we gain wisdom? You would think that we would, but we keep forgetting how it happened, or how it gains momentum, or, gee, how did we do this last time? Oh, yeah, history repeats itself. Right, right, I guess we go to war now, right? What became necessary, eventually, was to leave ourselves a message, something that would last the ages, something that would go past a generation, and maybe past many generations. And that is something that would have to be built out of a material that would withstand whatever the earth had to throw at it, whatever mankind could throw at it. And here's where it gets interesting. Sometimes we don't think too far ahead. A successful race is a race that can think beyond the next day. A hunter-gatherer only thinks about what he can put into his campsite that particular day. And then he has to do it again. And there are a lot of people who don't know how to do that. They just go out and shop for the day's groceries. They fill up a very small icebox. And then the next day they go out and shop again. Or worse, they don't shop at all. They just eat out every single solitary meal. They have no planning whatsoever. Or maybe they plan to the next paycheck. Or maybe the paychecks are a little too small, can't quite save enough out of one paycheck. Maybe it takes two paychecks. So they think 2 weeks in advance or 4 weeks in advance. And a more advanced race thinks a year in advance, 5 years in advance, 10 years in advance. They might take a long-range approach, 50 years or 200 years. Now you're talking a successful society. But we didn't do that. For some reason, time after time, we work ourselves to this precipice, and then we look over the edge, and we jump. But we had to leave a message. We had to leave it in stone. And that's exactly what the Maya did. So who were the Maya? Well, they were us. Yeah, they were us. I'm sorry. There's no way around it. We were them. Buried under the jungle for more than 500 years was the answer that could save us. We are nearing the end of the war cycle. You remember we talked about it. Mercy, peace, justice, and war. Mercy brings on peace. Peace allows the criminal intent to coagulate and rise to the top. Asking for justice, which brings the police force, and then eventually armies, and then armies go to war. And then when the war is over, you go back to peace. That's the cycle. Let's think about that for a minute. I don't know if you think we are at the end of the war cycle, but we are. Those that remember why we are even fighting are nearly gone. If we get one city block to stop pushing the wheel around, this wheel of mercy, peace, justice, war, it will stop rolling, and then it will fall over. It'll become a table. We can sweep up the rubble, and we can rebuild, and we can tear down the walls, and we can open up the water lines. We can begin falling in love with ourselves again. We can realize that mourning over a fallen brother is the very fuel that leaders make into propaganda films for the next generation of fighters. I was looking at a commercial for the National Guard in the just the other day, and the music was very modern. It was very catchy. It had a beat to it. The photography was certainly digital in nature and showed all the wonderful angles of being in uniform and trudging through mud and sneaking around rocks in the middle of the night with night vision or jumping out of helicopters, carrying a gun. And then you have to realize, wait a minute, this isn't a commercial for scouting. This is a commercial for killing. They forgot to show the guns actually firing. They forgot to show the projectile racing out at 1,500 feet a second and striking another human being, ripping through his flesh and causing him to die. They forgot to show the destruction and mayhem of bombs dropping in the middle of a city street. They forgot that part. They forgot what the concussion does to life. They forgot to put that in the commercial. And I was at a football game yesterday, Tennessee high school players playing against Kentucky high school players. That was wonderful to watch. The skillful teams of players that had never played together before, all wearing the helmet from their own high schools, and yet they were wearing either orange jerseys for Tennessee or blue jerseys for Kentucky, and they played a great game out there on the muddy field. But at the football game, because it was high school students from Tennessee and high school students from Kentucky, at the field, in uniform, were the recruiters for the National Guard. But they weren't wearing weapons. And they weren't talking about war. No, they were talking about careers. They were talking about college educations. They were talking about all the things that those high school students dream of because they live in small towns and fly over country. And they lure them out of their situations of poverty and scarcity with promises of income and success. And then they bag them up and they ship them to war. To fight who? For what reason? I'm fighting because I want an education. I'm fighting because I want out of my dumpy little hometown. I'm fighting because my girlfriend dumped me and I want to get out of this place. I'm fighting for what? What ideology? I raised my hands. I'm an American. I'm loyal. I'm going to do my duty to whom? You see how this war cycle goes? There is no uniformed army that we're fighting. In fact, the army uniform is a relic. It isn't the way wars are fought anymore. Wars are fought on ideologies. Wars are fought out of revenge. And I will repeat this. We can realize that mourning over a fallen brother is the very fuel that leaders make into propaganda films for the next generation of fighters. Now, it might take a few days for the effect to take hold. No more than this. Lay down the rocks and the bottles, turn off the tanks, and shelf your weapons. Pick up a broom instead of a rifle. And when the leaders, who may be the puppets of Wars R Us, scream at us to get back to fighting because they're losing money, we can smile. And when the armies of revolutionaries inspire us to throw the tea into the harbor, why don't we sit down and have a cup instead? When someone stands up and says, I will go to Washington to fight for you, put an X across that man. Because we need someone who go to Washington and work for us. We need someone who will go to Washington and voice our thoughts, our community, and our concerns. We need someone who will share our jobless condition with Washington We don't need a fighter. We need a lover. We need someone who loves his community so much that he will go to Washington and he will express that love. We don't need soldiers to pick up weapons anymore. We don't need drones or missiles or bombs or gases or harmful frequencies. We don't need that anymore. We can do this, you and I. We can take the hatred out of our language and out of our souls. It is ours to command, after all. Mercy is the precedent to peace, not war and conquest. Peace does not come because you win. Peace comes because you're merciful. Fear was never peace. Let me repeat that. Fear was never peace. Yes, the Romans had a peaceful period for almost 1,000 years. But it was peace through fear. When you have a child who obeys you because he's afraid of you, that is not a good situation, because when that child gets out of your control, heaven forbid you should have a heart attack and die, but more likely it will come because he's reached the age of 18, he has graduated high school, and he is leaving. He will do one of two things. He will either rebel against the fear that you placed upon him and go forward ignorant and unable to love himself, and therefore unable to love others, and he will clumsily stumble from one job and one relationship to another, or he will carry the same fear forward that you instilled in him, and he will beat his children just like you beat him. And we haven't gotten anywhere. Fear was never peace. Obedience does not come out of fear. Obedience comes out of love. We can seek out the good in one another and help it to grow. I can tell you this. We say it at the end of every single program. We can seek out the good in one another and help it to grow. I was discussing with my Christina, who I love very much in Israel, about resolutions for the coming new year. I told her I wanted world peace for my resolution. And then I retracted that and said, on second thought, I just want peace in the Middle East. Well, she said, peace in the Middle East is world peace. Those words amazed me. And before I go any further, I have to have my friend Mark from Albuquerque. Welcome to the program, Mark. I know he's there. Mark from Albuquerque on line one. I know the studio's working on trying to ring him in, so it's no big deal. Hang in there. Sometimes Mark's line has a little problem, but he'll be here as soon as you're able to connect him. Ah, there we go.
Hello, Brooks. Are you there?
Hello, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Ah, good evening, fine sir. Wonderful program this evening.
I appreciate that.
Touched on many things that we've spoken of in the past. And it's wonderful to hear someone speaking truth to
everyone. I had a good teacher. Mark was my teacher in some respects with this idea.
Not a teacher, just a reminder. Because we all know these things. We ignore it a lot, but we all know these things.
Well, I don't know if some people don't know them. They walk around like they think that the way to lead a family or lead a business or lead a city or lead a country is with a club. And I just don't think that that we have gotten very far as a race doing that. I think leading a country out of love and inspiration is definitely the way to go.
Oh, I agree with you totally. And some of the things you spoke of, the National Guard didn't forget anything in their commercials. It is intended to be left out, just as you don't see the flag-draped coffins anymore of the dead coming back, or any real cost of the war on any kind of media, because it's easier to sell it when there is no cost involved. Until
you mean when there's no eyeless, armless, legless veteran that comes back from a senseless war over oil, it gets a little hard to sell? Is that what you're saying?
Well, obviously, yes. And we're more and more speaking of it, but you won't see them on the regular media simply because it doesn't sell. It doesn't sell. And, you know, it's about time we quit buying. And that's the main thing is the only reason it sells, you know, it's the only reason it does anything is because it makes money. And if we're not buying, then they can't sell it anymore. And, you know, another to your point about the lottery, and that's hardly the least of the corruptions of this society that we've lived in. Once upon a time, the number runners used to get picked up by the cops, and now they're in every 7-Eleven. Used to be the policy men were arrested, but now they're the insurance companies.
the ones that run numbers, the protection rackets.
Well, it really is. I mean, all it is corporatized organized crime anymore, and it has been for quite some time. Now it's a shame, but that you don't hear about the mafia because, hell, they don't need the mafia anymore. The government took it over in a lot of respects, or the insurance companies, or these payday loan people are the loan sharks, or the...
Mark, there's a lot of acquiescence in our society. You know, we put up with this. We go to the bank. We put our money in the banks. We buy insurance. And if we don't buy insurance, then the government is going to see to it that everyone gets insurance, whether you want it or whether you don't. You know, I'm just going to quote this.
Well,
it says, if you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor. If an elephant has its foot on the tail of a mouse, and you say that you are neutral, the mouse will not appreciate your neutrality. And that is Bishop Desmond Tutu, just to let you know. Those of you that are sitting out there saying, well, gee, it's not my fight, you know, I didn't do anything to help it. Well, there are more. Another quote, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that it is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but one must take it simply because it is right. And that, my friends, was Martin Luther King, Jr.
And it's a great quote, both great quotes. One of the things I had stated at one time was, a nation that accepts corruption as the status quo is basically corrupted. And so many of us say we can't do anything because this is the way the system is. We are the system if we choose it. And if we just sit back, we all have this. And I don't know what the answer is because it's so endemic, other than to live as an individual with integrity, to expect those around you and have the courage to say, this is not right, when it's not right. And whatever the consequences are for that, those are the consequences, but you've spoken the truth. You've spoken your truth. And whatever happens, you are well within your heartfelt knowing that you are right without being judgmental in any way. It's most of us go through life, you know, if we get too much change back, oh, great, made a little money. I don't do that, and I'm not saying I'm holier than thou. It's just that I know that this person is working for minimum wage, and they're going to take whatever money they're short and deduct it from their paycheck. So if somebody gives me an extra dollar, I say, wait a minute, here, you counted wrong. This is yours. And a lot of times I get a surprised look like, why didn't you just walk away? Well, I didn't walk away because it wouldn't have been right to do that.
Very good.
It wouldn't benefit me. It wouldn't benefit you. So why would I do that?
Well, and, you know, Mark, it's not really the justice and the ethics of the community that we're worried about right now. It's the justice and the ethics of the state. You know, Plato said justice in the life and conduct of the state is possible only as it first relates in the hearts and souls of the citizens. Well, I can tell you almost without exception, it doesn't matter who I talk to, whether I talk to the university president over here on the other hill or whether I talk to the lady that serves hash browns in the morning down here at the Huddle House, they're all going to tell me the same thing. They feel that the state is corrupt. They feel that the ethics of the state has dropped to an all-time low. They feel like they're being robbed through their taxes, and they realize that about 55% of the dollars that they make in some way or another ends up as a tax. Sales tax for the things that they buy, income tax for the wages that they earn, hotel tax, motel tax, road tax, fuel tax, school tax, property tax, it goes on and on and on. And they don't feel like the state is doing anything for them except lording power over them. You know, even Jimi Hendrix said, when the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. But the state only has power in as much as we have relinquished ours to them.
This is true, and you know, the perception is the government of the people, but the reality is it's the government of the power brokers. And how do we wrest that back? How do we regain that is what we've been taught is what we are, is that it is the power of the people. Well, it takes some action, not necessarily violence, but basically it takes people saying, stop it. And not just one voice, but all the voices. And not, you're bad, stop it. Just stop it, we're your boss. Or we're going to fire you. And it doesn't mean we're going to elect another guy to go and get corrupt the same way. Because, you know, I've seen people with very good intentions go, and they get over there, and they say, well, I want to continue this job, and I have to, and then they get coerced. And they get, you know, well, you have to make these calls so you get reelected. And you have to go out and do this so that you get the money so you can be reelected. And if you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. And so just go along with this now, and then we'll get your stuff through. And it doesn't seem to happen. And even the best of men in that situation are just that man. Even if they go as, I'm a representative of the people, and I'm going to be here to do it, they get steamrolled. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's a reality. We've seen it over and over again with people. And how do we change that? That's the question. How do we change that?
Well,
and we change that by speaking.
Here's how we do it. In manufacturing, the enemy to good manufacturing is variation. We don't like to see non-conforming product at the end of the line. Everything's supposed to fit. It's supposed to have good finish, and we don't like variation. So the Japanese, through the inspiration of Deming and Juran, actually brainchilded a system called Pokeyoke. What this is a way of designing controls so that a part cannot be made incorrectly. And so we have this situation. In fact, one of my best listeners writes in and says, how does a citizen say no if they have no Zion to flee to? Here's how it's done. What we do in manufacturing is we design a system whereby the part cannot be made wrong. Now, what we have is we have a constitution that has set up the terms for congressmen and senators. Congressmen run every 2 years, which means they're in perpetual campaign mode. Senators run every 6 years. But there are no limits to either one of these. You know, senators weren't even elected. They were appointed by the state legislators up until a few decades ago. Then they began to be elected at large, and that's where the major corruption started sinking in. The thing to do in today's modern fast-paced society is to change the term of a congressman from 2 years to 4 years. That way, at least he has at least a couple years where he can do some work instead of having to think about raising money to get elected again in 24 months. The second thing to do is to limit the terms of both of these offices to three terms, 18 years for a Senate and 12 years for a congressman. This is a Pokeyoke. What it does is it prevents the dynasties from being formed in the first place. And then you take out the retirement plans and make them seek their own retirement plan just like everybody else does, and you pay them a decent salary. I would pay congressmen probably $5 million a year, and I would pay senators $50 million a year, and I would pay the president $200 million a year. And that would be it. Everybody's on term limits. You're in, you're out. And you know what? You're going to get some smart people for that amount of money.
I understand the concept since I was in manufacturing also. I would have to say that there would have to be some form of public financing thrown in, where there is no outside money to influence those people to vote one way or another, or to make it so that when they are running, that they take monies from corporations where it's doled out as being from each employee and, you know, well, limited to $1,000.
They don't do it directly. I mean, look at Nebraska. They voted for the health care only because they were exempt from the health care.
Right, right. I mean, that's what's been going on for decades, too. That type of wheeling and dealing for the votes, you know. And if it wasn't that, it would have been, well, we're going to build this bridge for you when, you know, because if you vote for it, or, you know, because this is your project to bring the bacon home to the taxpayers. And it ends up, it goes to the friends of the people that, you know, that's why it was a pet project to begin with. It's so convoluted anymore, and to simplify it as it needs to be simplified, because that is the true essence of getting back to, or getting to, what we would seek is a simplification, simply because complexity breeds ways to get around the complexities. And if it's simple...
Government has a way of just putting the restrictions, the boundaries upon everything. Government, the people, the community, the states. This is Lao Tzu said this, water is fluid, soft, and yielding. But water will wear away rock, which is rigid and cannot yield. As a rule, whatever is fluid, soft, and yielding will overcome whatever is rigid and hard. This is another paradox. What is soft is strong. So we are the water. Yeah. We are the life of our nation. We are at the headwaters of all the money in this country, not them.
Yeah, that's true, in a way. As long as they keep printing it. And they've been printing a bunch of it. And I'm waiting to see that come to a head, too. So it ought to be interesting.
Last time it did, it was called a depression.
Yeah. Well, the depression and the inflation that's been suspended by the increasing printing of money. This is the tidal wave that is being held back by Fingers and Dykes, and I hope that we get back into manufacturing more within this country, whether it's just small shops, for local, use or things like that, because we've run out of things that aren't being imported. We need to make things. We need to produce something other than McDonald's hamburgers or loans.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're trying. We're trying. We'll get this electric car.
And thank you for what you do in your engineering and with the company you work with, because you are trying and succeeding in innovative manufacturing, and that's a great, great thing. It's unfortunate that you can't be funded with enough to expand as much as you should be able to, but I would suggest to all the listeners to make that investment. I wish I could.
to mercifully resist being overpowered by the government and realize that they work for us.
Right. And I'll tell you the truth, for personally, I don't worry about what the government's doing. I really don't. Because it's gotten to be to the point where it's, holy mackerel, I can't watch the news because I get an ulcer. Holy mackerel, what are they doing? And how is it going to affect me? And it's all the things that may happen. While I have to look at, in reality, how is it affecting me right now? I have to pay taxes. I have to, no matter what I buy, there's a sales tax on it. I have to pay the income tax when it comes in. And what I can do is help who I can on it, who I come in contact with. To realize that if it's not in your experience, it's not real until it is. And to not get upset about things that aren't in your experience until you have to, and be ready for it when it is in your experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And most of our nation, we don't have this kind of experience. We can read it in the history books, whatever has been recorded for us by those who actually won and wrote their history books. But the gut, the thing that's inside of us that tells us what is right, what is morally right, what is ethical, what is wrong, has become so complicated and so legalized with legal speak that the average person does not know how to negotiate this world any longer.
I understand that, assisting people, I pretty much try to simplify it for those folks because they are so overwhelmed, and they find they can deal a lot better if they center themselves and come to love themselves and not hold themselves up to this media portrayed perfection, whatever it might be, and say, look, you're a beautiful being. You're here. You are, love yourself, as you spoke earlier. That's like the first step is love yourself. It doesn't mean that you're egocentric. It doesn't mean that you're self-centered. It means, gosh, who else are you going to love? If you're not loving yourself, how can you love anyone else?
And who can love you? That's the thing. If once you have that love of yourself, then you can make friends of people. Lincoln said, am I not destroying my enemies when I make friends of them?
Right.
That sounds a lot better than shooting them.
As you spoke earlier, what you taught your sons and the folks when you were a scoutmaster was self-sufficiency, basically. That's what it came down to. But you also taught them how to help others to be sufficient, to fend for themselves, to use that around them to help others, to put forth. Once you have this self-confidence, you know what you're doing, and you understand that, and you love yourself, then what can you do? Then you assist others to do this for themselves. And those others will help others after they have attained this and recognize it, and so on and so forth. This is really what humanity is supposed to do. Not without, it's not a judgment, but that's when it works so well. When folks are secure in themselves enough to help others, to become secure in themselves enough to help others, to become secure in themselves enough to help others. And then it's that relationship spreads amongst everyone. And I'll use the example of the earthquake in Haiti simply because it's happening now. My prayers and intent for all that can be saved to be saved and all to find their lives again. But if I was there, I would not be in Port-au-Prince right now. I would have already been 20 miles away or 30 miles away because that's where the center of the devastation is.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's water in the countryside, but these folks don't know to go away from the city because, I got to stay here because this is where the help is. I have to stay here because my family was killed here. You can't help your killed family anymore. Mourn them, yes, but don't kill yourself mourning them. Go and survive and honor them by continuing your life. I know that during Katrina, you had sheriffs on bridges stopping people from leaving and seeking outside of the area of devastation, which was a terrible exercise of power there. But and then when the government came in and said, okay, now we're going to bus you, that was okay. But if someone took the initiative and looked to survive themselves, then it would stop. But I'm not sure if that would be happening in Haiti now or not. But I'm sure there are those that have done that. And they say, well, if they have family somewhere, it'll go. I would think that you would just go. Why would you stay in the middle of devastation and wait for someone to save you? Does that make sense to you?
I guess there's nobody there, to tell them what to do. Nobody there to, calm them and reassure them and educate them. These are largely illiterate people. They don't have emergency services. There's no... of course, they're flying it all in there, and I'm sure, nation after nation will go in there and help, and Haiti will be a great vacation spot in about 5 years. Mark, we're out of time for this hour. I really appreciate the phone call. I got to take a quick break.
Okay, have a great evening, and thanks for taking my call, Brooks.
All right, thanks so much, Mark. Good night.
All righty, good night.
Well, there you have it, Earth Explorers. Hour two, a little bit long. No worries. We'll be back right after this.
Come on.
I saw that the kingdom must be interior before it can be exterior, that it is a kingdom of ideas and not one of brute force, that his rule is over our hearts, not over places, that his victories must be inward before they could be outward, that he seeks to control our spirits rather than bodies, that no triumph could satisfy him but a triumph that gains the heart, that, in short, where God really reigns, the surrender must be in the interior surrender of the convicted free men, and not merely the outward surrender of the conquered slave. Hannah Whitall Smith. Music by Lisa Gerard. Welcome back to X Squared Radio Hour 3. We're going to run a little bit short this time. We have about 40 minutes left. Phone lines are back open, 415-762-1161. We were talking about the mercy, peace, justice, and war cycle when Mark called in. And we talked about that we can seek out the good in one another and help it to grow. We talk about that at the end of every one of our programs for the last 5 years here on X Squared Radio. And I was discussing with my Christina, whom I love very much in Israel, about resolutions for the new year. And I told her I wanted world peace for my resolution. And then I retracted that, and I said, on second thought, I just want peace in the Middle East. Well, she said, peace in the Middle East is world peace. Those words amazed me, and they stuck in my head. So what will it take for peace in the Middle East? Impossible, people say. They have been fighting since the earth cooled. Actually, I like the word impossible. I made a career out of accomplishing that very thing. We have a little radio program called X Squared Radio. We have a little voice. We have a few thousand listeners around the globe. That's enough to make this happen. If you are willing to help us with a little experiment, and you know how we love experiments on this program, we can sow a virus into the future program written for us by the moneylenders. Only with this virus, when you catch it, you're cured. The first thing I want you to do as part of this experiment is to turn off the cable news programs. You can read the news if you like, but then you won't recycle it every 30 minutes the way the cable channels do. You can read it online, you can read it in a newspaper, but don't have Fox News or CNN or MSNBC on all evening listening to the bad news recycle over and over and over again. This will stop the fear cycle that is resonating across the country. The second thing I want you to do is to consider the leader that you sent to Washington to represent you. If you don't like who is running, then run for office yourself. I'm asking you to take the initiative and not be ruled. Go to your local city council meeting. Go to your local county commission meeting. You don't have to run for office. Just go. Take some knitting. Sit in the back row. Take some cookies and milk. Take something pleasant to read and sit in the back row and just listen. Sooner or later, you're going to find a place where you can get involved. And by the way, I want you to take one of your high school kids with you. If you don't have a high school kid in your house, borrow a friend's and get your students involved in what's going on with government. Now, sure, they're going to listen to a lot of sewer approvals and city park arguments and trash pickup and barking dogs and stray cats, of course. But occasionally, there's going to be the key struggle where local government is trying to solve something for the community, something that perhaps the community should solve for itself. If you can instill this involvement in local government, in the city, in the county in which you live, in your youth, then they will grow up with a sense of responsibility, involvement, and empowerment where they can actually do something on a larger level, on a state level, on a regional level, and even a national level. The third thing that I want you to do, and this is the hardest one, turning off the news is easy. Grabbing a high school kid and foregoing sitting at home and watching television on a Tuesday night and going to a city council meeting, that's doable, that's easy to do. This is the tough one. This is the one that is going to cause a life change in you. The third thing I want you to do is I want you to stop getting angry. I mean, remove the grudges from yourself. The goal here is to love yourself. If you're holding a grudge against someone, I need you to get rid of that. In order for this experiment to work, you have to get rid of the grudge. You cannot hate another human being. You have to realize that you can't externalize your enemies, and you also cannot externalize God. I don't want you to put God out there. I want you to put God in there. Yeah, just that thing right there in front of you, the thing that's holding your shirt up off the floor. That's where you need to realize is the saving power. It's also the destructive power. You know, depending on which part of the scriptures and which scriptures you use, God is a pretty violent fellow. He is a genocidal maniac on one hand, and he is a merciless, absolutely black and white, good or bad, live or dead God in several respects, and then he turns right around and he's merciful and blessing and loving. At least that's the way he's written about in the scriptures. But I think you know in your heart, in your mind, that that isn't the way he is at all. Or he is, in the scriptures, a reflection of you, and he is a reflection of me. So I need that reflection, in order for this experiment to work, to be clear. So I need you to wipe the mirror, okay? Spray some glass cleaner on the mirror, and let's get it cleaned off. Holding no grudges against one another, no grudges against God, no grudges against your church or your neighbor's church or your neighbor's faith. I want you to lay the rock down, put the bottle down, let's sweep up the trash, pick up the rubble. Somewhere along the line, somebody, and that somebody is you, has to say, I am not going to seek revenge for my brother. That was the last death. That was the last death. Enough. And let's say it out of love. So this is the experiment. Some would call it the World Peace Experiment, but that name has already been taken. There's a fellow out there who is trying to push the 100th monkey syndrome, where if we just say, you know, love will overcome, or love is the true strength. Yes, you can say that. But you got to start here. You got to start with the thing that's above your own 2 feet. That's where the security is. That's where the insecurity is. And the sooner you realize that you are self-employed, the better. Those of you that think you get up every morning and you go to work and you punch a clock and you work for the man, or you work for General Motors, or you work for the restaurant, or you work for the sewing factory, or you work for the automotive supply plant. You don't. You are self-employed. Okay? You are your own boss. And if your business plan isn't working out for you, then you need to work smarter. And maybe it involves a different source of income. And think about who's dipping their hands in your paycheck. What are they taking that money out for, and what are they using it for, and how can you keep more of it in your pocket and not give it to them so they don't have that power? These are all important questions that you can ask yourself with a blank piece of paper, and you can sit down and say, John Doe, self-employed. And are you treating yourself very well? Are you hard on yourself? Do you love yourself? Or do you feel like you're going to vomit when you go to work every day? So, realize too that although you belong to yourself, and now you're self-employed and self-empowered, you also are entangled. You're involved with all the other beings on this planet. In fact, it can be said, and I could make the case if we had enough time, that not only are you involved with every being on this planet that ever was and ever will be, but you are involved with beings on other worlds, in other times, in other dimensions, and you are a very real God yourself. You may be an embryo. In fact, you may be suffering from mortal brain damage, realizing that somehow you're separate from God, and you hear a little chuckle in my voice because that is, in fact, the truth. You realize that you are not separate from God, but that His blood pumps through your veins. His soul is the soul from which yours is made. What can you grow up to be? Exactly. So now you look at life a little bit differently, you're a little bit more empowered, and also realize not only are you entangled with every being that ever was, is, or ever will be, but you are mated, you are copied, you are not copied, you're mirrored, you're an image of other souls that are on the earth right now. And right now, they may be born in other parts of the world. They may be living in other areas, other countries, speaking other languages. They may be different ages than you. In fact, don't look at your children like they're young and don't know what they're talking about. They very well could be older than you. And in a past situation, may even have been your parent. And now the roles are switched. Look at those little people a little differently than the last time you looked at them. Because somewhere in there is a very ancient, very wise, and very experienced being that may be having a hard time fitting into this mortality. If you have a few years on them in this mortality, it's your responsibility, your duty, your honor, to help them adapt to this life. And if you're in a job of employment where it's your job to dig a pit for your neighbor, I want you to do a little bit of soul searching. You know, there was an interesting movie out recently. It was called Yes. It was with Jim Carrey. Now, yeah, it was a comedy, but it also had some very poignant realities in this, and I think Jim Carrey does a really remarkable job of wrestling with this radical shift in ideology for him. But the activity that he did in that movie as the banker, when he approved everyone's loans, which normally he would have said no. In fact, that's probably why he got the job at the bank, because he was so good at saying no. That's what banks do. They say no. And the more effectively they can say no, the more money they make. if they have to say yes because you did come in to the bank with everything that you needed and you did have good credit and they couldn't say no to you, well, then I guess they had to say yes. And that, in fact, is the name of the movie, The Yes Man. Jim Carrey's character learned how to say yes. And look how he affected lives. Between the lady who wanted to make decorator cakes to the guy who wanted a new motorcycle, those lives were changed in a positive way, and the bank involved itself in the credit and the finance of the community. And the joy and the growth that that bank enjoyed because of it and the community enjoyed because of it were nothing short of phenomenal. And it could happen everywhere. But such is not the case. The reality is that there are people out there who have jobs, and it is their job description to discriminate and deny people access to capital, access to influence, whether it's in politics, whether it's in insurance, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's in finance, whether it's in technology access. What we have to do is we've got to rethink the way that we are entangled one with another. We have to realize that we have a soulmate out there. In fact, you may have several. That's right. You may have several soulmates out there. Now, does that mean you have to go out and marry all of them? Does that mean you have to go out and have sex with all of them? No, it doesn't. But it does mean that there's a possibility, and quantum physics is all about possibilities. It's all about probabilities and the potential of all potentialities. That's what quantum physics is all about. On a very small level, yes. But on a macro level, it still applies, although you're dealing with a much larger population. The probabilities become more academic, more predictable. But on the quantum level, you are dealing with very, very small sample sizes, and you're dealing with forces that may be interdimensional. Maybe not so much on a macro level, at least we hope not. We don't want whole planets popping into existence in our neighborhood. That would very much ruin our afternoon. But on a quantum level, that's exactly what happens. Particles, photons, energies pop into and out of our dimension all the time. There is an exchange of power on a quantum level, which for all clarity is a very small level, not accessible by electric vehicles or power generation devices. It's there, yes, but you'd need an antenna the size of California to gather enough energy to light a light bulb. On a quantum level, we are dealing with possibilities. This is what matter is, but it is not what souls are. Souls are timeless beings, ancient in their nature, that are currently having a mortal experience. If you're listening to this program with ears, you are probably having a mortal experience. That means you qualify. But it also means somewhere out there, not necessarily in your own town of 900 people, and not necessarily in your town of 10 million people, is a soulmate or soulmates. And your compatibility, at least for a mortal relationship, marriage, or loving, or cohabitating, or however it is you want to come together and build your empire, is a matter of commitment and realization of who you are and what you are willing to be and what you are willing to do, not so much what you are willing to have. Having is something that our generation has become enamored with. In fact, I think the whole commercial world is dedicated to the having. There's hardly a television commercial, a radio commercial, a billboard out there that doesn't have some key to its message relative to having things, not so much relative to doing things or being. And it's nice to sit around and be, but if you just sit around and be, sooner or later you're going to starve to death. If you don't believe me, look at some of the swamis and the holy men of India and China, and you will see. In Tibet, they're nothing but hair and fingernails after a while, because that's all they are, is a conjugation of the word be. Sooner or later, you have to do. That means you have to get up off your butt and realize that you are self-employed. That unemployment check that you're getting belongs to me. It belongs to the other guy that's out there working. It doesn't belong to you. And your receiving it robs you of your own dignity. Now, I'm not asking you to give it back, but I'm asking you to get off of it as quick as you can. And if you can't find a job, it's because you haven't figured out that you're self-employed yet. You work for yourself, and when you're not working, when you're not doing, then you can't have. That's the way the laws of nature are supposed to work. Now, what's happened is that you have relinquished your sovereignty to another because you have decided not to work, and you've decided to sit out there on unemployment and tell people you're unemployed and you're looking for a job. Realize that you work for yourself. If you're not working, it's because you fired yourself. And I would think that one of the greatest motivators to go to work is hunger, just like one of the greatest motivators to getting warm or to staying covered up is getting cold. So you have to realize that the experience that you bring to this world is more than you can imagine. The things that you have already been through, the births and deaths that you have already been through, have eminently prepared you to be here at this time. There is hardly a hymn in the hymnal that doesn't talk about a former life. Now, it might not have been a mortal life like you think of it now, but I guarantee that you have been a sovereign intelligence feeling pain and joy and challenge and learning things and forgetting things and making mistakes long before you got here. For a lot of people, it's a lifelong struggle to try to make a connection with that, to try to remember what it is you're supposed to know. Some people hit the ground running in this world, and other people never get their footing. They never figure it out. I'm here to tell you, don't listen to anyone who tells you that you're fresh out of the box when you get here. You get one life, and you go back to the dust and you don't get another chance. That's utter nonsense. That's not the way gods are made. That's not who God is. That's not who you are. Every form of energy is eternal and can never be destroyed. And intelligent energy fits this even better than other forms of energy. Because why? Because you're self-employed, because you are self-sovereign. Nobody rules over you and nobody owns you, and you could be happy in a prison cell just like you're happy in the middle of a meadow or in the middle of a busy city or at a concert or making love, because you are a sovereign being in control of who you are, what you do, and maybe not so much over what you have, but you have to realize that what you have is not the goal. Filling that garage with toys, filling that living room with the finest furniture, adorning your fingers and your arms and your ears and your tongues with jewelry is not the goal. That's not why you're here. If you think it is, you are mistaken. Get on the right track. Realize that security begins with your left foot, and it ends with your right foot. So why in the world would you tell yourself no? Why in the world would you tell yourself you don't deserve to be what you want to be? Why in the world would you tell yourself you cannot do what you want to do? When you wake up in the morning, on Monday morning, and you go in to that place where you're self-employed, I want you to ask yourself, do I love what I do? Do I love who I am? And if that answer is no, or if that answer is maybe, or if that answer is, you know, I don't really know, there's not much time left. If you're 30 years old, you're only going to live 100 more years. Believe me, it will go so fast, so fast. 50 years will go by in a weekend. And if you're upset because your kids are running around like cowboys and Indians, making noise in your house and playing too hard and too loud and to harshen your calm, don't worry. All that noise will go away in a few seconds. And then your house will be empty. And they'll be gone, and they will be what they want to be. So I want you to savor the playing of children. I want you to savor the laughter. I want you to savor the skinned knees and the jilted girlfriends and the broken-hearted boyfriends. I want you to savor every moment of that, because it's all the mortal experience. And when you're separated from the one you love, revel in that separation, because when you come together, there will be a nuclear reaction from which solar systems draw their energy. This is you, and this is us. And we're all entangled together. Now, this is a program of science. It's a program of possibilities. It's a program of unlimited potentials. We bring the past and the future together here in a mathematical equation called X squared radio. We have about 6 minutes left. Time for one more phone call. 415-762-1161. Have a lot of people texting in. You think all this brilliance is mine? It isn't. It comes to me also from lots of friends around the nation and around the world, from as close as 3,000 miles away and as far away as 10,000 kilometers. So it all comes in. Remember that you have eternal life, that the brain that is in your head is only the lens for your consciousness. If it doesn't work the way you think it should, you can work on it. You can reshape it. You can reteach it. You can build new synapses all the way up until you're 150 years old. Your brain is building new connections. And if you think you lack what it takes, start reading. Go back and listen to the last 4 years of this program. That'll get your brain started. And then start picking up books and read, because when you read, it starts storing information in your brain. And then your brain does things like make connections and make transitory relationships that open up things and instill new insight into you. Listen to music. And I don't mean the stuff that's on the radio. I mean, go listen to a classical concert. Go to a high school jazz band concert, the music. If you play a musical instrument and you've laid it down for a while, pick it back up, because those musical instruments can rewire the brain. If you're not realizing that the brain is actually the lens for your consciousness is completely independent from your brain. You may have come into this world handicapped, and you may come into this world blessed with a a 6 gigabyte computer on top of your shoulders. But it can all process your consciousness for beauty and for mercy and for justice. And let's talk about justice just for a little bit, because I disagree with Martin Luther King on one thing, and that is this justice thing. Justice is the one point at which that mercy, peace, justice, war cycle gets its biggest kick, because revenge sometimes gets misinterpreted to be justice. That being made whole, getting back what was stolen from you, hurting someone else because they hurt you, taking what someone else has or has worked for because they hurt you or they took from you. That kind of justice is what's destroying the world. Realize that if someone stole from you, they took something that you had. They took your money, or they took your car, or they took your bicycle. It is their karma that is harmed, not yours. You are a sovereign being in charge of yourself, self-employed, and you make your own choices as to whether that's going to affect you or not. Now, you can say it is justice to prevent that person from doing it to someone else. Yes, of course, lest mercy should continue to turn the cheek and through apathy empower those who would take advantage and harm others, because then the blame for the next person that's victimized is yours. You get involved and you make sure that that person cannot do it again, and don't think so much about what's in it for you. Think about the next woman that's going to be raped. You think about the next businessman that's going to be denied a loan and driven into bankruptcy because some 25-year-old banker decided he was too high of a risk for the money. The truth is, the most temporary thing in society is a financial statement. The most temporary thing in modern society is a financial statement. If you don't believe me, just ask Bernie Madoff. Also, poverty can be changed into wealth with a simple change of attitude, away from scarcity and toward abundance. Making the universe resonate with your ideas is only a mathematical proposition. And if you don't understand the mathematics behind it, that's fine. You can pick up Volume 3 of The Ark of Millions of Years. It's got a good foundation for you there in Part 2. The book that's about to come out, and I'm going to try to have it ready for the publisher by the end of the month, will give you everything you need. It will tell you stories, and it will show you the relationship between energy, your energy, and the resonance of the universe, so that you can be anything you want to be. And you can do anything, anything that is your heart's desire. And hopefully that desire is for good. And if you've enjoyed the program tonight, please go to xsquaredradio.com. Sign up for the archives. Those sign-ups are what help us keep the lights on and help keep the studio paid for our time it takes to come on the air. This is our fifth year of X Squared Radio. And we wouldn't be here without you. We'll see you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you
will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.